All right, everyone. Thanks for being here. I don't know if anyone's still out drinking in the bar, but we'll just let them come in. So again, I'm John Greenberg. I'm the columnist and the editor of The Athletic. Very honored to be joined by Scott Harris, who is the director of baseball operations for the Cubs.
Thank you guys for having me.
Is it on?
Testing. Is this on?
Yeah, it's on. You might know him best as the comic foil in some of the long-form journalism about his boss, Theo Epstein. But we will get into that. First off, let's talk a little about what you do with the Cubs. What does the director of baseball operations do? Like, what is your day-to-day life like?
Well, first off, thanks for having me. So the best part about my job is I get to wear many different hats, depending on where we're at in the baseball calendar. I work a lot with Jed and Theo, and during the season, so right around now, I end up traveling a lot with the team, pretty heavily involved in general roster management, sending guys down to the minor leagues, bringing them up from the minor leagues, putting them on the DL, and really communicating with the coaches and Joe to try to make sure that on any given night we're putting out the 25 players who give us the best chance to win. And then now, starting this week, we're going to really dive into the draft, which is coming up in early June, which is a great opportunity for us to add talent to the organization. And we really lock ourselves in a room and we bring in our amateur scouts and our cross-checkers and all the R&D guys in the office. And we start devising draft strategies to try to pull as many impact players out of the draft as possible. And then right after that, we try to sign those players as quickly as possible, get them back on the field, and then it's full trade deadline mode.
Is this the first time you've been in a bar without your World Series ring?
Did David Ross tell you to ask that?
How often have you worn it out? Let's be honest.
I haven't.
You haven't?
The coolest thing was I brought my parents to the ring ceremony. And my dad grew up in Chicago. He's a diehard Cubs fan his whole life. Billy Williams was his hero. And it was pretty cool watching him put it on for the first time. But after the parade, we all went back to the clubhouse. And David Ross grabbed me and he said, "Scott, are you still single?" And I was like, "Yeah, Rossi, why?" He said, "Just promise you when you get that ring, you'll take it straight to a bar. You'll never be single again in your life."
So, you know, you were, when you got hired, you were like 25, right? Yeah, 25. I mean, you went to UCLA, played lacrosse, you had some internships. What was it like, I guess, you know, we can talk about the path. What was it like being the young guy in this front office and being hired? You weren't with these guys in Boston.
I didn't know any of these guys, actually.
So how did you let's start with that. What was the interview process like?
It was pretty interesting. At the time, I was working for the commissioner's office in New York. I was 25 years old. I was going to Columbia Business School on the side. So working and going to school, not sleeping a whole lot, but life was really good in New York. And I didn't really anticipate leaving at all. And then Theo and Jed took over the Cubs, and they called me and asked me to come out here for an interview, and I didn't know any of these guys, but it was obviously a pretty good opportunity trying to learn from those guys. And I came to Chicago, and as soon as you walk in that door, the culture they created is palpable. It's a real camaraderie in the office. You can really trust the guys in there. And obviously, Theo and Jed have done everything in this game that you could ever hope to want to do. So as soon as I came in, I felt like I had a really good interview. They asked me more about myself, and were trying to evaluate my fit in the organization than baseball questions, because I think they leaned on the people I worked with for to gain some credibility on that front. But when I left, I thought, you know, this is a great opportunity. I'll take it if they give it to me, but I'm still just 25. I don't think it's going to happen. And I'll forever be grateful to Theo and Jed, because they're two guys who don't really see age, they see ability. And I think they trusted me to take this job way before I even trusted myself. I think it was pretty far over my head, and they trusted me to grow in it and really excel.
Did you look up to Theo? I mean, he was the kind of guy that became an idol for a lot of kids that wanted to get into baseball. You know what I mean? That knew they weren't going to play baseball, but maybe wanted to be in it. Were you a guy that was like, whoa, who's this Theo Epstein guy?
Yeah, I actually wrote a letter to him in college, and he totally blew me off.
What did the letter say?
I wrote a letter to every GM and president in the game, but I changed the deer line to make it sound individualized.
Right.
But I think he saw right through it. He blew me off. But no, I mean, I think you always look to people in the game who have a similar background to you. I think everyone who's gotten this game, it's always started as a pipe dream. It always started as a long shot, and you look to people like Theo for inspiration and for some optimism that, you know, hey, one day maybe I could do this.
Who got back to you out of those presidents and GMs?
There were a handful of people that got back to me. A lot of form letters back.
Right.
But when I started, I didn't really know anyone in the game. So even getting a form letter was pretty exciting for me at the time.
Right. And Theo got started by writing to Calvin Hill, Grant Hill's dad, who was working for the Orioles at the time. I was talking to you, I was reading the Francona book. And that's like, that's such a random way to do it. How did you know them, though? Did you know them from the Major League, from the commissioner's office? Did you know them a little bit through that?
I didn't know them at all. My boss at the commissioner's office is a guy named Peter Woodfork.
Okay.
And Peter was the director of baseball operations with the Red Sox when they won the World Series in '04. And so he was at the commissioner's office, and I worked for him. And I think Theo and Jed called around and asked for some promising candidates, and my name came up, and Peter gave me a good rec. So.
So you joined in fall of 2012, right?
Yeah.
So what was that? 2013 was the worst year. I mean, they all say that was the toughest one because it was still far away. I remember 14 talking to Jed, and he was very optimistic, you know, because you had the Russell deal and stuff like that. But 13 was like the wilderness. I mean, you guys can go to Baseball Reference and look at some of those names on that team. What was it like joining that front office? Like I said, you don't know those guys, but you're coming in this situation. What was it like then?
Yeah, Jed talks about that as the toughest year, and I think I agree with him. It was pretty bleak in July and August. You feel like you're making progress at the trade deadline every time you trade players like Feldman and those type of guys for young prospects that you believe in. I think at the end of 2013, there was really a source of optimism for us. We started to see these young guys really perform, really put up numbers in the minor leagues, and one of the coolest things was we started watching every minor league game during our big league game, so we'd pay attention to the minor league games also.
also or instead of?
in addition to. No, but one of the things we did late into the night is we would keep refreshing game day, or if they had a video feed in Daytona at the time, which was our high A affiliate, or in Tennessee or Iowa, we'd be watching those games, and you know, every time Javi would go deep, there would be this long text chain. Like your phone would light up at, you know, 11:30 at night, talking about, you know, the pitch and where he hit it in the game situation, and that was really exciting for us.
So it's basically like Cubs Twitter was at that time, except it was just you guys had a little more insight.
Yeah. No, it was – so the end of 13 is when it started to turn. 14, I think Theo often refers to as our dirty little secret. We felt like we had the building blocks to a very bright future at that time. And I feel like the public hadn't really jumped on board yet, hadn't really understood, you know, the names and the players and their characters and their work ethic and – the household names that you guys know now, I think we started to view them as household names in end of 13, early 14.
You know, it's funny when I think about it now, and I know this is when Sahada was working with me at ESPN Chicago, and he was our freelancer. He was like the extra baseball guy, and he was writing a lot about Arrieta. And I remember the Arrieta thing, because remember he kept going, coming close to like no hitters. But no one was like focusing on Arrieta, right? And is that what, kind of what you meant by dirty? Like you guys saw Arrieta that year, and we're like, holy shit, this guy's gonna be a horse.
Yeah, we brought him up for a spot start after we traded for him. And you can go back and watch that game. He had premium stuff at that point. And he always had premium stuff coming up through the minor leagues with Baltimore. And he never quite put it together in Baltimore. But there were reasons to believe that this guy could put it together at some point. And all the credit really goes to him because, you know, as much as we want him to put it together, as much as we try to put him in a position to put it together, he's the one that actually puts it together. Him and Sahada for, you know, recognizing him and identifying him and texting us to trade for him. So
well, the funny thing about that trade is last year another someone who's close to Reinsdorf said to me, he's like, how come people don't write about the time the White Sox almost traded for Arrieta? And I was like, I didn't know that story. And then someone, you know, I end up talking to Rick Hahn about it and how they had Jesse Crane ready to trade for him. And then Crane, they're like, well, his elbow's a little sore. And the Orioles are like, well, you know, we got some other deals going. Is he going to pitch or not? And they're like, better make the other deals. Now, Jed will say that Buck Showalter really liked Feldman. and that he wanted Feldman to start. But that shows like kind of how close those two things can go. I mean, you see that all the time, right?
Yeah. My parents don't really understand what I do, I feel like. But they always talk to me in late July, and they're always wondering if I'm getting enough sleep and what we're working on. And then they always see one or two trades at the end of July, and they say, kind of, what took you so long? Or what have you been working on all month? And the reality is, for every trade that we actually do pull off, there's 12 to 14 that we were working just as hard on that never came through. Either we pulled out of the last second, or the other team got a better offer from somebody else, or they shifted gears and they didn't want to be sellers anymore. They wanted to go for it. And so things change quickly, and every team's situation is very fluid at all times. So it takes a ton of work for in the office and with our scouts and R&D folk to make sure that we're ready to jump on those opportunities and try to get an area at a type.
You know what? I think we need to rally for this interview. Can we have someone bring something out to rally us?
Yeah, this is going to happen.
Here we go. So
we're not playing today.
When that story came out, so that story of you having to eat carbs, and I think most people here know it, especially the guys laughing, it came out in Wright Thompson's ESPN, the magazine story. And my thing was, I'm reading it, I'm like, this is a great story, better than I thought it would be even. I'm like, Scott Harris's parents are probably like, ooh, a story about Theo, let's see if he mentions our son. And it, and like, wow, Theo bullies him and makes him eat carbs. It makes him eat loaves of bread. How many texts did you get from that story?
From you or everyone else?
Everyone else. And me.
A lot. So the full context of the story is this. This is spin also. So there's a group of us who watch every game in the suite, in Theo's suite behind the plate. And they're long games, and there are a lot of them. And we end up talking about the game for 95% of the game up there. And we're always talking about anticipating what's coming next and talking about the state of our team, talking about our strengths and weaknesses. And there was a game in late July of last year where we were struggling to score runs. We were playing the White Sox, and I think they had shut us out the night before. And it's very commonplace up there to engage in in-game antics to try to
in-game antics
to try to create some mojo, to try to create some run scoring. And on any given day, you'll see Theo eating some relish, or you'll see someone else sitting outside in the cold without a jacket until we score a run, things like that. But I happened to be up there when the ESPN guy was up there, and so that was, I think, 2 weeks after this game in July. But anyways, the game in July, we had got shut out the night before against the White Sox, and I think we had scored one run in the game, and our offense was lifeless. And so Theo started picking on me, because he always does, because I'm the young guy and an easy target and all that. And we started negotiating back and forth. He says, what are you willing to do to help us score runs? And, of course, his suggestions were completely outlandish, but we compromised, and the goal was to eat a full chocolate cake to inspire our team to score runs. And so he ordered a whole chocolate cake from the dessert cart. And it was a big cake. It was about this deep, this wide. And he just put it in front of me and gave me a fork and told me to start eating. So I started eating. And about halfway through the cake and about halfway to diabetes at that point, Javi came up and hit a two-run homer, and we ended up winning 8-1, which I felt really accomplished at the time. I felt like there was a direct link between eating cake and hitting homers. But it turns out it was the worst thing that ever happened to me, because every time we need runs from now on, I have to eat something, or it's become a shtick in the box. And so he made me do it when the ESPN writer was up there. And, of course, it ended up in ESPN, the magazine. And, of course, apparently a lot of people read that. So I started getting a flood of text messages.
And then it started. Then, like, other people wrote about it. And, like, yeah. It just became, like, one of the – when a team's good, that stuff becomes, like, you know, mana for writers. Like, these little details that shows how much fun. I mean, how much do you get – like, you know, I know Theo and Jed a little bit, and I know their sense of humor, especially Theo's. How much shit do you take – is it a daily type thing, or is it kind of toned down a little bit now that you've been there a few years?
Again, I'm an easy target. I just being the young guy, you can't really say no to anything. But I think the best part about the OMJED is they really create a fun and inclusive environment. We work so many hours pretty much every day of the year, and they create this kind of cub circle where a lot of the pressures we feel in our jobs are very unique, and it's hard to relate to other people, relate to your friends or parents or siblings, because they're dealing with different stresses. And so when you try to tell them about the pressure you're feeling up at the trade deadline or negotiating a contract in the off season, they don't really understand it. So we do really lean on each other, and it's become a fraternity-like environment in our jobs, and that keeps us motivated, keeps us sharp, and make sure that we're having fun while we're working these long hours.
What's the funniest story you could tell about either of those guys that you can tell here? What's the one you tell people, like, when they ask you about, what's Theo like? It's got to be PG. 13. Is there any PG stories
that
about
eliminates
Theo?
A lot of them.
I know, that eliminates most stories. Is there any, are there any funny ones, any ones you tell, like, you know, family members and stuff like that?
Well, it's not an individual story. It's more of a theme. Jed is a much, much more talented athlete than Theo. At pretty much anything. If you were scouting Jed and Theo, you'd probably take Jed over Theo every single time. But Theo beats Jed in every single game they play. In basketball, in ping pong, in bubble hockey, in everything. And he just has this determination. And sometimes that determination fits within the rules, and sometimes it doesn't. But in the end, he always seems to win. And I think that's what makes him good. I think he's always the most competitive person in the room, in any room he walks into.
What about going into the fall? I think that's the most you and I talked was probably during the playoffs, because you're always on the field, you and Jared Porter.
Did you call me a youngish Turk?
Something, a young Turk. And you're like, what's that mean? I'm like, aren't you supposed to be, guys supposed to be smart?
Well, because people started texting me about it. I didn't know what I meant.
And then people started texting me about all the pictures I was taking of Jared Porter and Sahadev.
You drove Jared Porter out of town.
You guys were kind of the face, though, of, like, the front office, though, during that time. Because I think other people, it wasn't just us going up to talk to you. I'm sure other writers were. Theo and Jed didn't want, like, the feeding frenzy every day. What is that like when you're, and you go on the road a lot for them, like, you know, on road trips. What is that like, and what do you have to, how have you gotten, like, comfortable, I guess, dealing as, like, a face of the front office?
Yeah, the road is a lot different than being at home. I really value the time traveling with the team, because oftentimes when you're at home, the players have so many different things pulling at them. They have so many off-field marketing opportunities or families pulling at them. And most of that doesn't exist on the road. I feel like when you do travel, everyone in the traveling party is in the same bunker. And it's a great opportunity to build meaningful relationships with the coaches and with the players. And, you know, when you're in Cincinnati, there's not a whole lot to do there.
Come on.
Within the context of a three-game series. And so you end up spending a lot of time with players and coaches, and I think you really build the foundation for meaningful relationships there.
You know, we saw you guys. We all ran into each other that one time at lunch, and then we kept going back to that spot. I think you guys did too. And I told Jed this, like, before game seven, Sadov and I are sitting in the window eating. And we see him come out with his wife and his friends, and he looked really nervous. Like, and I've talked
Absolutely.
About that. He was like, his wife gave him a big hug, and I was like, what did you end up doing? He told me about how he ended up taking a run. How did you deal with nerves for those last, like, three games, basically the last four games, you know, three games, when you guys were down 3-1 until you guys took it?
They weren't much different than the nerves for the entire month. I mean, you felt the same nerves watching Cole Gillespie in San Francisco. You felt the same nerves in game four in San Francisco, knowing that there's a potential to go back to Wrigley and have to face Cueto and Bumgarner coming out of the bullpen. The same nerves in L.A. when our offense wasn't playing up to their ability. And then you get to Cleveland, and we're just all basket cases in those moments, you know, because you can't do anything. You can't make a roster move. You can't make a trade. You can't do anything. You're basically sitting on your hands, and you're trying to be a fan at that point, but you have much more invested in the team and the outcome than the normal fans do. I think the hardest part was, and I think most people in our front office would say this, was in the eighth inning when you're four outs away from winning the World Series, you're up 6-3, and you start getting a flood of text messages from friends congratulating you on winning the World Series. And in that moment, you're conditioned to be pessimistic until that final out is recorded. And so all of us had the same reaction where you're turning your phone off, you're not looking at any of that stuff. But all of that stuff adds to the nerves. And I don't think it's just us in the front office. It's the players, it's the coaches. There's a real human element that I think people often forget.
Yeah, I mean, I could see, and you could see the release, like, after you guys won. You know, I remember seeing you in the post-game clubhouse popping champagne. Theo got drunk after, like, two drinks. I've never seen anyone get drunk quicker than that. But the nerves had to have helped, and the tension, the release of the tension. Like, I end up walking down and end up being around, I'm trying to think, I think Jason and a couple other, it wasn't Jason, it was a couple other guys, Euclid. And those guys right when they won, and just to see everyone run down. I mean, was it just a release for you?
Yeah, it's amazing. Someone gave me some great advice before the playoffs in 2015. He said that when you're winning a playoff game, it feels like the longest game of your life. It feels like every out takes a month. When you're losing, it feels like it's the quickest game you've ever witnessed because you're just counting the outs. You're trying to create a roadmap to tying the game and taking the lead. And game seven was just pure agony. And once KB threw the ball to Riz, you still have that split second reaction of, is that it? Yeah. They can't come back again? Rajai Davis isn't going to be up again? So it was a great opportunity for us to let loose in the clubhouse.
So in the NLCS, you're back in L.A., and you probably have a lot of friends there. A lot of people want to see you. What was it like, the moment when you guys kind of snuck Kyle Schwarber into Dodger Stadium for the BP?
Anyone who told, I think there were a lot of writers who wrote this, that this was the master plan, that we were going to bring him back in the World Series and we're going to shock the world. And we had planned this ever since we were in Arizona and he first went down. Anyone who tells you that is probably lying. Even in L.A., I don't know how many of us really thought he was going to be ready to play. I think what he did in the World Series is one of the most impressive athletic accomplishments I've ever seen. You know, if you just go back and look at game one, you look at his at-bats against Kluber. Kluber was pitching like the best pitcher on the planet there, and every one of his takes was perfect. Every one of his swings was right on. And I mean, he was driving balls in games one and two in Cleveland, and he hadn't seen live pitching in 6 months. And that's really, really impressive.
Yeah, I was talking, I mean, he talked about it, and I talked to Hap about it in spring training, saying just watching Kyle take pitches in the fall league was like the most amazing thing he's ever seen, just like standing there. When you first found out this was a possibility, how excited were you? Like, I thought it was like, it made it such a cool story, like the imagination behind it.
Yeah, it's a great story, but you don't really expect him to do what he did. You know, in hindsight, it's pretty incredible that he did what he did, but it so easily could have gone the other way. It so easily could have turned into a situation where he's completely overmatched at the plate and nobody would have faulted him because he hadn't seen live pitching in 6 months. And everybody talks about how he tracked 1,000 balls a day on a pitching machine in Arizona, and a ball coming out of Corey Kluber's hand in game one of the World Series in Cleveland is very different than coming out of a pitching machine in Mesa. And so I don't think any of us really knew how it was going to go, but we really trusted Kyle. We really trusted his ability and his work ethic to do everything he possibly could to prepare himself for that moment.
Okay, so right now the mood for baseball, it's an interesting mood with Cubs fans because there's people that are optimistic, people obviously have trust because you guys won a World Series. But, you know, I know you guys are disappointed with how things gone. The players are obviously disappointed. What is the mood like in the front office right now? As you guys are, you know, getting ready for the draft, you're getting ready for trades, and you're keeping track of what's going on in the field.
It's, in these moments, it's really important to stay level-headed. It's really important to try not to ride the roller coaster, and it's much easier said than done. I think it's important for many people to realize that last year's start was an anomaly. Starting 25-6 is very rare, and now you add Kyle Schwarber back to the mix, and you add Ian Happ, and you do a couple things, but largely you have the same team, and everyone just expected, okay, now they're a year older, they're closer to their primes, they're going to go, you know, 27-4, and I think at some point you're going to see a similar team as we had last year. But I think it takes time, and I think that the best thing we can do in the front office right now is just trust the character and the togetherness and the camaraderie amongst our guys that, you know, that's going to shine through in the end. And once we get past the small samples of the early season struggles and guys really get into routines and they really start to play up to their abilities like we saw last year, I think you're going to see that same team come back. And I think it's a great moment right now to believe in this team and believe in this group.
You guys are really excited about Eddie Butler coming. And what you saw, even when you signed him and then spring training kind of verified that. When you guys left Mesa, you're like, we're going to see him. There's a good chance we're going to see him this year, right?
Yeah, if you look at him, he had many of the things we look for in pitching. He had a very decorated prospect history. He was one of the top five pitching prospects in the game a few years ago. He faced adversity in Colorado. It's really hard to pitch in Coors, but he showed throughout his tenure in Colorado that he had really great stuff. And when you have the opportunity to get a guy like that, you should do it because you never know what's going to happen. A lot of guys do really live up to their potential when you get them out of certain situations. And we always talk about undervalued and change of scenery guys. And he was a guy that was at the top of the list because you could really dream on the guy. You could dream on his stuff. You could dream on the performance in the lower levels of the minor leagues. And you really wonder what it was going to look like when you got him out of Coors and you brought him to Wrigley and you put him in our pitching infrastructure. And you really just hope that would really unleash his potential. And hopefully it does. I mean, you saw him on Friday night pitching with a great fastball in St. Louis. And hopefully that's just the tip of the iceberg for him.
I mean, you obviously want to be where Theo and Jed are as a number one decision maker. What's the most important thing you've learned, I guess, if someone like me or if someone interviewing you, for someone says, what did you learn? What have you learned from these guys maybe that you didn't think you would learn?
With those guys, you really learn that it's not a race to get to where you want to be. If someone wants to be a GM or a president or whatever, it's not really a race to get there. It's all about trying to be prepared for the moment when you do get that chair and you do get to be the top decision maker. You want to do everything you can to make sure you're prepared to make the right decisions. I think too often people treat it like a race, that once you get to that spot that you're going to know exactly what to do and you're going to be able to leverage your experience and make the right decision, as Theo has demonstrated time and time again. But I think, you know, part of what makes Theo good and what makes Jed good is they've spent so many years doing this and so many years learning from their struggles in Boston and their success in Boston, and then Jed going to San Diego and working for a small market team and then coming back in Chicago. I don't think there's any substitute for that experience. And so that's one of the things I've really learned from them.
You know, we're going to end in a few seconds, but you had a very big part in a major Cubs moment last year. I don't think I know what a lot of people know about. And that was that it was your idea to go to the bleachers.
That is true. Print that.
Tell them what happened, how that came about to go out there. Because that was a moment I think people really loved. You know, they really enjoyed it. It made them kind of feel connected to Jed and Theo and everyone else.
So our suite's right behind the plate. And 81 times a year and in the playoffs, we stare straight out at the bleachers and we see all you guys out there having so much fun. And you really get jealous. And I had never sat in the bleachers before. Most of us had never been out there before. And it was early in 2016. We'd always talked about, you know, what it would be like if we went out to the bleachers one time. And early in 2016, I kept asking Theo if we could do it. And finally, I think he tried to shoo me away with, okay, if we clinch the division early, we can do it. And late in September, as we were on the doorstep of clinching, I reminded him. And I reminded him that he promised and that we have to do it. And I'm going to do it without him, but he should be there. And so we did it. And I think it took all of about 4 seconds for people to realize that that was a fake mustache and a hat and glasses. And it was Theo. And it actually got uncomfortable because I think Al Mora ran up to us and tossed us a ball. And the guys in the bullpen grabbed me afterwards and said, yeah, we saw you guys walking down the aisle to your seats before you even had sat down. But
there's
really
a fan behind you guys, like, tweeting out pictures.
Yeah, they were tweeting out pictures and video, and it was really fun. I had never been out there, and that view out there is incredible, and you really get a feel for what makes all the Cub fans so special. And I was amazed how into every pitch they were, and how informed they were and how much they read up on decisions. And I mean, some of them were even asking us questions out there, and And I was really impressed because you look out there from our vantage point, and it just looks like a huge party the whole time. And that's actually what drew us out there. But I was really impressed.
That's kind of, it's good because you guys, because your position, don't get to interact with fans a ton. You know, and you're separate. You're thinking of the game as your job and your business. So that must have been, is it like, did you have a better appreciation, like you said, for fans after that, for the experience?
Yeah, absolutely. They were so fully invested in the game. And that, at that point, was, I think we had clinched. Somebody lost, and we clinched that night at midnight, and we texted each other, and it was totally anticlimactic, but Theo allowed us to go in the bleachers anyways the next day, but it was a totally meaningless game. We'd already clinched the division, and still all the fans were hanging on every pitch, and they were anticipating every move of our players in the game, and that was really impressive to me. It showed how bought in they were to that team at that moment, and also, you know, the potential we have in the future.
Will you give us the team's preferred trade lists for every team?
No, but I appreciate you tweeting that out.
That's one of my questions right here. I think we've taken up a lot of time. I really appreciate it, Scott. But we do have one more surprise, I think, from our guy. You know, because we're celebrating so much. We got some cake.
That's a cupcake.
We got the bread.
I only do cake.
We got what?
That's a cupcake. I only do regular cake.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll split it later. We got some sweet Mandy B's cupcakes. We appreciate it, Scott. Really, thanks for helping. I think everyone enjoyed the questions.
Thank you for having me.